Music is streamed and purchased digitally nowadays with services like Apple Music, Spotify, and Tidal. But what have we lost through this new technology? In his book, The New Analog, Listening and Reconnecting in a Digital World, Damon Krukowski of the indie bands Galaxy 500 and Damon and Naomi examines what has changed in music in the transition from the analog era. Things like the disorientation of hearing things through headphones and the flattening of voices to the loudness of mastering and absence of noise. This book is published by The New Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Damon Krukowski to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Did you start thinking about what you write about here because of frustrations you experienced when you were recording your own music?
Well, some digital tools have been a great boon to my own career because they're affordable. So like many musicians, I've migrated to digital largely. But I really wrote it because I've lived through this period because of the age I happen to be, that I started in an all-analog world, and here we are now.
In the old days, you'd go into a studio with a lot of very expensive equipment, tape that was something like, what, 2 or 3 inches high, 2 inches high, and went around at very fast speed. Now you can record a perfectly fine record in your living room.
In fact, I do record in my living room. I've recorded in my living room since digital made it possible, starting in the mid-90s. I bought a horrible machine called ADAT, A-D-A-T, which used to put 8 digital tracks onto a VHS tape. But it was so cheap. And why it was so useful was it was silent. And that's a lot of what I write about, because digital materials can be silent so easily, and that's so difficult to achieve in tape.
You write a lot about noise as a crucial transmitter in music. What's noise in this context?
Well,
are we talking about the sound of air?
It could be.
Because often people complain about digital recordings as sounding airless.
That's right. Well, because, to an audio engineer, as you know, we talk about signal and noise. And signal means, very simply to an engineer, anything that you're paying attention to, like my voice on the radio now. And noise to an engineer is everything else. So it doesn't necessarily mean noisy, but it means whatever's not signal at that moment. And what my book argues is that in analog media, you always have both present. You have signal and noise in a relationship, and engineers call it the signal-to-noise ratio. But in digital media, you can simply erase the noise and be left with 100% signal. And I think that's a really... In music, I think it's a significant change, but actually I think it's a change in all our communications right now.
But it makes things sound unnatural, doesn't it?
I think it does, because in the natural world, in the world that we exist in outside media, just in time and space, we are always sorting through between signal and noise, and we're very good at it.
But we've always changed things, distorted things. In the days when AM radio played a lot of top 40 music, they used to boost the bass sound because AM tends to be strong on the treble.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't feel that digital is necessarily not less real, per se. It can be very realistic. But I think what it is that it doesn't put the sorting of signal and noise into the listener's hands, or ears, shall we say, or mind. So whereas in analog media, it's really up to you at each moment what to listen to as signal and what to listen to as noise. In digital communications, we're really given the signal by the platform, by the software, by the corporation. And we don't have an option of what to choose. And I think we see this, say, in social media, for example, on Facebook. You have a feed that is determined largely by Facebook. Even though you may choose your friends, Facebook will sort the posts. And they'll decide for you which of these you should pay attention to and which they think you can dismiss. And that's signal and noise.
Then there's the whole matter of iPhones, for example. They're manipulating the sound of our voices in phone conversations.
Yes.
It's both natural and unnatural sounding.
Yes, I agree. Even Apple's vice president, I saw introduce the iPhone 5. That was a generation ago. A generation of technology happens very fast, not a generation of people. And he was saying how the signal of our voices on digital lines don't sound natural, and they're trying to figure out what to do about that. The reason they don't sound natural is that your voice on the cell phone is digitally processed, it's treated, to remove what the engineers have decided is not necessary to understanding the words that are transmitted over the phone. And that, in other words, is noise. So among the things that they remove are things that we use in regular space to judge the tone of our expression or our feeling. So, for example, it's very difficult to whisper on an iPhone. It's very hard to really communicate intimacy on a phone.
But we know about the cell yell.
Exactly. So we're all yelling and we're all saying, "Where are you? I'm here." And then, you know, we're our communications seem very diminished.
But couldn't that be boosted just by better digital technology?
It could be, but it would be inefficient. But we certainly could. And my book is not meant to be a tirade against digital. As I say, I use it myself. And I think that we can use digital. In fact, we have to, and we're not going backwards. But I think we need to be a little bit more aware of what we're not including as we make this translation from analog into digital or from the real world into digital.
Is the subculture that loves vinyl part of this, a rebellion against this?
It's an interesting question. I mean, my book doesn't really cover the vinyl revival, but I do see in this sort of yearning, it's very young people really mostly who are fueling this new revival of interest in vinyl. I do see a kind of a quest for more communication, as if something is missing. And I think that it is, if not specifically about noise, I think it's almost an intuition that they're not getting the full story.
The reason I thought about vinyl is you speak about thick listening to describe the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds.
Yes, I took that term from an anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, who talks about thick description. And his explanation of thick description was he took the example of a gesture, say like a thumbs up gesture. Well, you can say one-to-one, oh, that must mean something's good if you come from the outside of a culture. But then if you think about it from inside a culture, we use thumbs up to mean lots of things. You could do it ironically. It could be a quotation. It could be, you could ultimately be saying something's bad by putting your thumb up. And what Geertz was saying was that you needed a full cultural understanding to have a true description of a gesture, for example, in anthropology. I think it's similar in sound. When you have the signal and the noise, when you have a fullness of explanation, when you have an LP with the back cover and the liner notes and the producer credits and where this was recorded, why it was recorded, who was involved, you have a much larger picture of the meaning of the music, not just the signal of the sound.
And that's a frustration for me, a jazz fan, when I go to Pandora and I know, sure, that John Coltrane is playing tenor, but I'm not exactly sure who the pianist is, and they're not going to tell me.
Exactly.
Or they don't tell me who the producer was. They don't tell me whether it was recorded in Rudy Van Gelder's studios in New Jersey.
Precisely, and that's all such crucial information, as all jazz fans know. I think that jazz and classical have been particularly poorly served by these new digital services because there was such a strong tradition of knowing all the information around a given recording. Yeah, but I think it's true in rock, too. I mean, to take an example from my own career, we cover songs, meaning, like in jazz, we play another songwriter's song, not just always our own singer-songwriter material. On the old way, when we made a record, we credited the songwriter, of course, and our fans knew whose song this was. And we were making a gesture that was more than just the song. We were also signaling who we were learning from, who we were listening to, who we admire. We covered Yoko Ono in our first band, Galaxy 500, at a time when Yoko was still much maligned, especially in England, as the woman who broke up the Beatles kind of thing. And we were saying, oh, we love this song, but we were also saying, Yoko's cool, you know. And now young people come to our shows, and they think we wrote those songs. So they'll say, oh, I love that song, Listen, the Snow is Falling, that you wrote. And we're like, no, we didn't write it. Yoko Ono wrote it. But they can't know that from Spotify or Pandora. And even Apple Music, they don't list credits.
Although this is nothing new. People thought Barry Manilow wrote, I Write the Songs.
He didn't?
No. Bruce Johnson wrote it, talking about the Beach Boys. My guest is Damon Krukowski. He's written a book called The New Analog, Listening and Reconnecting in a Digital World. It's published by The New Press. You mentioned recording in an analog studio. How was that experience different than recording digitally?
Yeah, in a way, that's where the book began, because I thought, people are not going to experience this again.
There still are analog studios out there.
You can still do it, but now you're doing it as a sort of an antique experience, as a reconstruction of something that used to be, the way that you could, you can always find an enthusiast for a bygone technology. But when I first started recording, that's all there was. And we went into a studio, and tape was expensive, time was expensive. And so we knew we had to record quickly and as best we could in the given amount of time, and we had to live with our mistakes. Those are all things that have changed drastically with digital.
How did the German band Can utilize the special qualities of an analog studio?
Well, Can is a very favorite band of mine, and one of the things I love about them is the way that they treated their studio equipment and their machines, even their instruments. And what they did was they listened very, very carefully to the tapes that they made. They were recording on analog tape. And Can, being very serious German musicians in the 70s, they studied with Stockhausen, but they made rock music. They listened very carefully to their own recordings, and they heard sounds on them that they could, none of them could remember making. So they devised a very logical experiment. They turned on all the machines and the tape and left the building. And then they came back to listen to what the machines had to play. Mm. And, of course, they did hear sounds because there's noise. And the studio makes its own noise. The room itself, the machines, the tape itself, all of that contributes to an atmosphere that's not a deliberate signal from any of the musicians.
And when people are doing edited interviews, we do ours live, but when they're doing edited interviews, they often record ambient sound, a couple of minutes of it, so that whenever there is a transition from one speech to another, it doesn't sound like there has been a cut.
That's right. Something else I've noticed that people are doing now digitally in recorded interviews is they're eliminating the silences between thoughts or conversations, or even within between words, so that you can speed up someone's language without noticing, really. But you're dropping the silences out, and it changes the pattern of expression, the sense of someone thinking.
What is Murphy's Moore Law, and how does that apply to music? That's not Murphy's Law.
Well, it is, in a way. So Moore's Law is the idea that was from an engineer named Moore, who predicted that computer power would double, I think it's every 18 months, because of solid-state technology circuitry. I made a coinage for the book. It's tongue-in-cheek, but I also do mean it. Murphy's Law is, of course, the idea that everything can go wrong, will go wrong. What I say in the book is, if something was better before digital circuitry, and it's just getting faster every 18 months, if it was better before, it might be getting worse at that same incredible rate. We might be losing information, for example, take signal and noise. We're able now to, as I said, like you can speed up a podcast now if you want. You can say, I'm going to listen to this half an hour show I only have 15 minutes in my commute, and just play it faster. And the pitch won't change, and the algorithms...
That's the big difference. In the past, you sped up, it sounded like chipmunks talking.
Right,
but
like
now,
chipmunks.
The voice quality is the same. It's just that everybody's talking much faster than they really do.
Right, like they do it in those ads, at the end when they give you the crazy thing at the car ad, No. They're just dropping all the silences out. I've heard that people are listening to podcasts this way because it's practical, and digital technology allows you to do it. Now, what it's doing is dropping the silences. But, and this is the argument I make in the book, noise is communicative. And as humans, we are very good at drawing meaning out of noise, out of a pregnant pause. If you're just going to say, okay, but it's efficient to just eliminate all the pauses, what about the gesture of a pause, of a silence, of a pregnant silence? These are bits of communication that we're very, very good at and that are part of our human expression, but we're losing them in the media.
How are streaming services changing the way people consume music?
Well, in some ways, it's been wonderful. I mean, I really enjoy the incredible reach that I can have through streaming services. I can find music from all over the world. It doesn't have to depend on the distribution network of a label and stores like the old days. So I find things, for example, on the wonderful website Bandcamp, which I like a lot, bandcamp.com, which operates it's a commercial site, but it's slightly outside the normal. It pays bands very fairly. And I can get music from mainland China, for example, from there. Which is remarkable. And that, by the same token, they can get my music. And this happens, this kind of exchange. And yet...
Just don't do any songs that attack Chairman Mao.
Or even mention the number, 1989. You can't do that over there. It's amazing. But at the same time, I think that streaming encourages a quick listening, a flatter engagement, maybe. It's efficient. And the efficiency is for signal. It's not for the rest.
What has the Echo Nest done to help Spotify's streaming service?
Well, this is a wonderful thing on Spotify, I think, which is their Discover tab. If you use Spotify, you can ask them to make suggestions for new music for you. And that's a type of thing that all the online services do. Amazon, everybody says, you know, well, if you like this, you must like this. The one on Spotify is actually, the software was designed by two very, very clever MIT grads who had a company called the Echo Nest that Spotify purchased. And they use qualities of music to, as sort of applying big data principles to listening. And I have to say, just as a consumer, it works. It's spooky. They can predict things that I really enjoy that I've never heard of. And I'm a denizen of used record stores. It's amazing to me that they can find things I've never even laid eyes on. And yet, they were right. It's in my wheelhouse, so to speak.
And you can always reject it if you decide that it's not to your taste.
Yes. Now, the thing that is different, though, as useful as that tool is, I find that when I do hear the music that way, for one thing, I don't get the rest of it. I don't get where it was recorded, who it's connected to, who are the players on it. So as the type of listener I am, I usually end up then researching all that on my own, or even finding the original LP, you know, which is kind of silly.
You can Google it, but that's a lot of extra work. Whereas when if you just had the album cover or even the CD case, it takes 10 seconds.
It's true. Also, you can Google and end up with a lot of misinformation, as I think our politics are showing right now. For example, if you believe allmusic.com, which is a good source for a lot of liner notes information, I played drums on a Jimmy Smith record. But I can promise you, I never played drums for Jimmy Smith. But that has been in my listing.
Oh, I thought you were so good on that record.
I wish I had played. I wish I were that good, and I wish I'd had the opportunity. But I never did. But that is in my listing, and I cannot erase it. I've written all music. You know, misinformation persists online in this very bizarre way.
You write about the loudness wars of the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Again, that was a sort of result of digital technologies, where suddenly it was possible to refine a volume boost to a much greater degree. So you could push everything to its absolute level right before it was too much. And records got louder, louder, louder. I think they got louder by a factor of 10, something unbelievable like that. And it makes things sound bigger and stronger when they're louder. But really, it's just louder. It's not better. And I think, again, to go
that
back,
explains a number of groups.
and again, some of our politics as well. You know, louder is not always better. But it's a sort of seduction of digital. It went so far, I tell this anecdote in my book, that even Metallica fans, Metallica is a ridiculously loud band, petitioned the band to release their record quieter. It's just really amazing. At the point at which Metallica's fans are writing an online petition, it's gone too far.
I was surprised to find Jane Jacobs in your book.
Well, that's very important to me. I grew up in New York City, in Manhattan, and Jane Jacobs was an urban observer of Greenwich Village when she lived there. And she
wanted to preserve neighborhoods.
Exactly.
That's what she fought for.
And she saw the value in some old ways that were being torn down at the time by Robert Moses and other proponents of urban renewal. And she fought some of the sort of automatic ideas that were circulating at that time. We talk about the internet as a highway, sometimes that metaphor, and Jane Jacobs actually did stop a highway. And what she was doing, she wasn't trying to say, let's not change anything. But she was saying, there's some things that are happening in neighborhoods that you're going to destroy and you're not finding any way to replace. Like people hanging out on the stoop and taking care of what's going on in their street. It's a very simple, low-tech solution to street crime. And she fought that. And the metaphor in the book is that I think we're in a similar moment with digital media. We're tearing down analog media. We're destroying our newspapers. We're destroying our radio. We're destroying our music industry, our publishing industry, for the sake of digital efficiency. Some of that may be truly good, but some of it is a problem, and some things we're tearing down we actually still need, and we need to find ways to bring them into the future.
Damon Krukowski was in the indie rock band Galaxy 500, currently one half of the folk rock duo Damon and Naomi. He writes for music and art journals, including Pitchfork, Art Forum, Freeze, and The Wire, and he has a new book called The New Analog, Listening and Reconnecting in a Digital World. It is published by the New Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.